I met our speaker this evening. I met him here at Ridgeview. He is an alumnus of Ridgeview. And he would sometimes come to the Saturday morning men's meetings, which I chair out here quite a bit. And one day after the meeting, he came up and gave me his name and phone number and asked if he could tell his story, because I also do speaker meetings on Sunday night. And so, sure, I'm always glad when somebody volunteers to tell her story. In fact, anybody out there who wants to volunteer, see me after the meeting if you have a year or more of sobriety. Anyway, his name is Chris. And so Chris told a story out here several months ago, and I was profoundly, influenced, or I was, it touched me very deeply about the honesty in his story, and the clear-cut honesty that he went through to get his mind in a good state of mind so he could work the program properly. And I thought, my gosh, man, I mean, that's what we all need to learn how to do. We all need to learn how to do that. And so that's the reason why I wanted to invite Chris to come here to tell his story tonight, because I think he does have a lot of things to say that can help all of us. So, Chris, it's time for you to come up here.
Wow, huh? Ridgeview First Friday speaker meeting. I gotta tell you, this is a really big honor for me. Because I was at one point sitting here while I was a patient here at Camp Ridgeview. And I was like, wow, how cool is this meeting? You know, there's a big stack of chips, you know, and they're cool chips too. They're the clear ones, you know, and then it's like you can't get them anywhere else. And I just, to be able to come up here tonight is just really a really big honor. I'm Chris and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 4th, 2010. My story begins in Cleveland, Ohio. It's where I was born and raised. So some of you guys know Akron and Cleveland are pretty close. So Akron, you know, where this whole entire AA thing kind of started. So Cleveland is pretty big in AA. And I got to know about it a little at an early age. You know, when I was young, I got to find out a lot about alcoholism and drug addiction, because if you shake my family tree, there's a bunch of us kind of fall out, right? When I was 16 months old, my father was killed in a drunk driving crash. Come to find out later on, when my mom was that same age, her father was also killed in a drunk driving crash. So guys in our family die in drunk driving crashes. And I'll tell you, when my wife... was about to give birth to our son, that fear that I might end up just like that, it's pretty tough. And it still kind of bothers me a little bit, but the thing is that today I'm sober, right? So I have that chance for that not to happen to my child, you know? So that's one of the things that helped me, you know, try and stay sober, because I don't want that to happen to my son, you know. So growing up in a household, you know, my mom, you know, she remarried. So I got the stepdad, you know, along with the stepdad comes, you know, they want to have kids of their own, you know, so there's now I've got two younger siblings, right? 7 and 8 years younger than me. And I'm the only person in my family with my own last name. Everybody else has got their last name, right? So immediately I'm growing up as an outcast in my own family, right? So this automatically puts me in a position to where I don't fit in early on in life, you know, to the point where everybody has a family dinner table, right? And a lot of families, they get together and everybody has dinner at the family dinner table and things like that. But the problem was in my house is that I didn't have a seat at my family dinner table. I had to bring one in from the dining room, or, you know, find a cart, chair table, whatever it was, man, I had to go find my own. And that then sets up another part where I don't fit in, you know. And so this is one of those things that I learned early on in my life, and it sticks with me for a long, you know. I also learned that, you know, drinking and drugging was where it was at, you know. You know, we had my family was a big social family. They liked to party. You know, they would have, you know, big parties and things like that. And both sides of the family, they would socialize a lot. And shot time, was one of those parts where everybody was involved in it. It doesn't make a difference how old you were. You know what I mean? It was, opa, shot time. You know what I mean? Everybody comes running in, everybody gets a shot of Black Velvet. You know what I mean? That's how it was. And I was a part of that. And that made me feel, all of a sudden, now I get a glimpse of, okay, they say shot time. I come over, I'm a part of something. So there's all of a sudden, there's a pattern starting to be built in my life where I can see that this makes me a part of, right? And I'm like 10 years old, you know. I remember, you know, Christmas mornings opening up presents and just getting shit-faced drinking mimosas and stuff like that, you know. But that was the thing. I was a part of, you know, and it made me feel like, you know, somewhat of an adult. You know, I felt closer to my stepfather because, you know, he was just that, you know what I mean? And, you know, so as time goes on, as I get older, I start to understand that how problems are dealt with in my household, right? Celebrations. We celebrate with alcohol, maybe some pot, you know what I mean? Hardships are going on in the family. There's financial difficulties. Mom and the stepdad are arguing. There's different things like this. And what happens? Well, then there's drinking, right? So I learned now is that when good stuff happens in my life, I celebrate with booze, right? And when bad things happen in life, well, then we drink them away, right? Now, I'm not going to sit here and try and tell you that my parents or the way that I grew up or my family history or anything like that is responsible for my alcoholism, my drug abuse, and the things that I did. No, they are not. You know, I am the alcoholic. I am the drug addict, right? And though I may have learned some things, though I may have been born with this disease, this allergy, in no way are my parents or the people I grew up with or anybody that I came in contact with responsible And that was it. And I had to swallow that. I had to learn that, because I can't blame anybody for the things that I did. I can't push it aside and say, no, that was because of you. I can't do that. And the reason why I can't do that is, and it took me a while to get there, but as I worked through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I understood that, right? You know, I got to Ridgeview February 11th of 2014, you know, and my sobriety date was February 4th that same year. But Ridgeview was, that time was not my first rodeo, right? You know, when I was 19 years old, I went away to college, and you know, I had a breakdown. I had a nervous breakdown is the way I call it, right? Things were going on at the house. You know, mom and the stepdad, there's like divorce, they're separated. I got two younger brothers and they're caught up in the middle of it. And there's all this stuff going on at the house, you know, and I got late night phone calls from mom reaching out to me, and I got the little brothers calling me, you know, they're reaching out to their older brother crying and saying, hey, you know, Chris, when you coming home, you know, daddy's not here. We know all these things, right? You know, and so I'm a 19-year-old kid in college, man. I don't even know how to handle it, right? I got all these new things. I'm responsible for me now, right? But then but a few hundred miles away, I've got a family that is crying out, and I feel that, you know, that I have to solve their problems when I don't even know how to solve any of my own, right? The only thing I know is that when I have a problem, I drink and I drug because I can't handle it, right? I don't know any other way. You know, I really didn't. So I ended up in this little psychiatric hospital in Nowheresville, Ohio. I don't even think they had a stop sign in this little town, right? Just a psychiatric hospital and a little corner store and a few things like that. And while I was there, I got transported from the hospital in Toledo, Ohio, by EMS to the psychiatric hospital. How I ended up in this hospital in Toledo is because the EMS came to the dorm room and took me to the hospital. When I got there, I later read that my BAC was like a 0.474, which, you know, is pretty ridiculously high. I think five you can die. So I was lucky in that spot. But I think that they thought at some point in time that I was trying to commit suicide, you know, that I had drank myself to that point. And, you know, I don't know. I can't tell you if that was a conscious thought, but it had been a thought for a long time, you know. I end up in the psychiatric hospital, and they don't have a whole lot of 12-step stuff there. But they do talk a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous. They do talk a little bit about what drug and alcohol addiction is, and they just really were trying to clear my head up a little bit, trying to give me some sort of coping tools and how to handle life stressors and stuff like that. So I hang out there for a little while, and I learned a few things, you know. They have small groups, right? And so I learned to try and talk some of my stuff out, you know. Sure, some of you guys that are here, you know, you get thrown into these small groups, and it's like, man, I don't want to talk. I don't know this person from Adam, you know, or this person from a can of paint, and they want me to talk and stuff like that. I felt that same way, but what had happened is it actually gave me a sense of relief when I said something, because all of a sudden people were able to relate, you know, and I thought, oh, well, for the first time in my life, someone, I'm not the only one who's experienced this type of stuff, you know. I'm not that unique, you know. So after that, you know, I stay sober for a little bit, but not quite, you know, sure that I'm an alcoholic or an addict, you know. They send me to AA and tell me that, you know, if I go to AA, then I probably have a better chance of not coming back. This is what they basically said. But AA, when I was there, you know, I was young. I was 19 years old, right? And that was my ticket out, that I was 19. And I couldn't be an alcoholic. I couldn't be a drug addict, you know. I hadn't used all the drugs out there yet, you know. And there was a lot of alcohols that, you know, were still coming out, you know, and that I hadn't tried, you know. So I was like, no, I'm not doing this. This is not me. You know, I'm a drummer. You know, I'm a musician. You know, I write poetry. At least I thought I could write poetry. You know, because that's the thing is, like, I thought that all this, you know, these creative people, man, you hear Hendrix and all these greats, you know, Garcia, you know, all these great artists, you know, in the 27 Club, all these people, you know, that they needed to get high in order to be creative, right? And those were my heroes, you know? So I wanted to be high, you know, I wanted to be creative, but and that's what I thought was my catalyst. That was my excuse. I'm 19. I'm a musician. Leave me alone. I'm cool. You know. Meanwhile, on the inside, I couldn't. I had no self-esteem. You know. So I decide. You know, after sitting in one of these meetings, and I swear to you, man, it sounded like this old country song. You know. This old guy up there, and he's probably my age now, but he's this old guy, and he's like, you know, well, I lost my truck, and my wife left me, and my kids won't talk to me, and I got no job, and my dog ran away, and I'm like, Christ, man. I'm freaking in college. I'm in the marching band. You know, I play drums, dude. I ain't got nothing to do with no dogs running away, losing a truck, wife, kids, job. No, man. I got this whole thing going on, and you guys are trying to ruin this. This isn't going to work for me. I'm out. You know what I mean? And that's the thing is that I didn't listen. You know? Later on in life, I find out that those are called yets, as in these are hasn't happened to me yet. Sure enough, a lot of those things did come to play. You know, never owned a truck. Got a dog in sobriety. So I couldn't relate, you know, so I bounced, you know, and things progressed on, and I made some poor decisions. You know, I got a DUI up there. That was fun because I got a DUI in this little tiny town in Ohio, and they were so small. It was Barney Fife small, right? It was like the Andy Griffith Show. Like, they didn't even have a gate on the jail door, okay? And when they sentenced me to a weekend in jail, it was at the Holiday Inn, okay? So my first consequence for having a DUI was, all right, I'm being locked up in a Holiday Inn and I got free HBO and the Tyson fight's on. Hell yeah, you know what I mean? So I'm not getting anywhere with this. This did not help the cause, you know? So whatever, it was a scratch, a bump, you know, a scrape. Oh, you know, of course it freaks the family out. Okay, we got another one of those alcoholics in the family, you know. And that's the thing about what is that one of the other reasons why I didn't want to come here. I didn't want to see you guys. I didn't want to sit. I didn't want to hear your stuff. I didn't want I didn't want any of this because of the fact that the people that in my family, the friends, when they decided that, you know, they'd gotten their ass kicked too many times by booze or drugs, they were gonna change their way of life a little bit, You know, there was an empty spot at the Thanksgiving table, or they weren't showing up for Christmas or the 4th of July party. Well, you know, they weren't there anymore. So I get this idea in my head that when people stop drinking, they disappear, man. You know, they're not a part of anymore. They're not in the family anymore, you know? And it's like they've been banished. You know, well, I've already had this feeling of banishment my entire life. I got to pull a chair up to the dinner table. I'm not going to do that. I can't do that because then I have nothing, you know? So I didn't want your AA. Not at all. And I come down to Atlanta and it's going to be different, right? You know, I went from Cleveland to Boston to Toledo to Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, then to Detroit, you know, and all these things, all these geographical changes were reasons to cure my drug use and my alcohol consumption. It's going to be different in Pittsburgh, it's going to be different over here. And the thing is that, yeah, I mean, maybe that was the intention. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to get away from the dope man, and I wanted to get away from the bars, and I wanted to get away from this crazy chicken, all this other stuff, you know. I wanted to get away, but the thing is what I couldn't get away from, what I could not get away from was me, you know? That was the bitch of it, because no matter where I went, I was there, you know? So in the first year down here in Atlanta, and I'm like, oh, this is gonna be great, you know? I'm in the South, you know, and I got nobody, I mean, I got my mom, but, you know, but I mean, I didn't know anybody, you know? I wasn't cool, you know, and that was fine with me. I was gonna be, you know, I got a job at CNN, you know, and it was gonna be awesome. I was gonna be an audio engineer, and I was gonna soak up all my time. I was gonna, you know, dig into life, you know, and work in and really pursue this career and all this kind of good stuff, and that was the idea. In the first year, I get another DUI. In the first year. Yeah, things changed real quick, didn't they, you know? I caught up with me again, you know? And I used the excuse of being an audio engineer, I needed to be creative. I needed to be able to hear things that people don't hear and be able to put it out there so that you can hear them, you know? Whatever. And so that was my, that didn't work for me, you know? And I get a DUI and I hire this lawyer and... He's like, man, you know, you know you have a DUI up in Ohio, right? And I said, yeah. He's like, well, that's on your record. And he's like, you know, they got this new thing where stuff follows you wherever you go. I was like, well, I really was hoping that didn't happen. And he's like, so what we need to do, man, is you need to do something. You need to intervene on yourself. You need to check out get into an IOP program, maybe even, you know, hell, it would probably be good for you to check in for 30 days somewhere. And I'm like, no. I'm not checking in nowhere, man. You're not locking me up. I'm not like that. You know, I'm not that bad. You know, I can handle this. You know what I'm saying? So what I did do is I reached out and I came here to Ridgeview that in 2001 as the evening IOP to stay out of jail. You know, because I knew that the jails down here were actually real jails. And I got a taste of it when I got arrested on that DUI, and I was like, wow, this is great. Anybody been to Cobb County Jail? Oh, they don't call it jail, an adult detention center? Yeah. That wasn't fun. So I was like, well, this is Cobb County. I can't imagine what anything else is going to be looking like. So I just wanted to make sure I didn't go to jail. So I did that, right? I came here and, you know, when you come here, they want you to go to meetings outside of here. Go to AA, here's a meeting sheet, fill this out, come back, you know. But I didn't want to really, I wanted to do only what was kind of necessary to kind of get me through. I wasn't going to dive into this. I wasn't going to buy this. You know, I didn't get a big book, But what I did do is I did go to a couple meetings. I did stay sober. I wasn't happy, of course, you know, doing it. But I didn't drink and I didn't use for that period of time that I was here. And I went through court and I got released. You know, everything was cool. It was done. And but I wasn't, you know. You know, it all started to catch up to me. I started to feel something about myself that I didn't like. You know, alcohol and drugs had saved my life for a long time. They really did. It kept me out of me. It kept me away from the world. It slowed down the hamster wheel that was inside my head. You know, it slowed down the voices, that noise, that clutter. You know, only if you've been there can you understand that when you put your head down on the pillow at night, you can't close your eyes because there's just so much stuff in there. You know, and alcohol and drugs, you know, they stopped that. You know, they slowed it down. They gave me an opportunity to sleep or to breathe or whatever it was, you know, until the point where it caught up and it didn't, you know. My disease lined me up homeless in the streets of Atlanta. And yeah, a guy like me doesn't do really good in the streets of Atlanta, you know. But that's where it took me, you know. I was homeless. Fortunately, I'm kind of charismatic. And that's my wife. I was able to do a lot of couch surfing, you know. I never really had a physical address. I didn't sleep out on the streets too many nights. Usually when I did, it was in sort of a bush somewhere or something like that. But I did spend a lot of time. I befriended a manager at an all-night diner, and she let me stay sleep in the bread closet. And I remember living down there, you know, and it's cool down there because there's parks everywhere, right? You know, you got Piedmont Park, you got Woodruff Park, you know, there's Centennial Park. There's like all these really cool, you know, parks out there. And, you know, I'd be walking out there and I'd see these people in these parks and, you know, they'd be like walking their dog, you know, and they got their Starbucks and they're all smiley, you know, and everything like that. And then someone goes walking by, hey, Nancy, hey, Joe, you know what I mean? They have a little conversation and they laugh and they chat it up and they look happy, you know. They look like they got something going on, you know, and they're enjoying themselves. And I'm like, man, these people suck. You know, I don't like these people. How can they be walking around like this? How can they feel? I mean, they look to me like they had something going on. You know, they were enjoying something in life. They were enjoying being outside, you know. And me, I couldn't enjoy anything. I didn't want to live anymore. You know, the birds pissed me off. I didn't like birds, man. I hated birds, you know, because that meant that I'd been up, you know, forever, and I didn't want to hear the birds, and, you know, I didn't like birds. I got over that, but, you know, there came a time, you know, when, a friend of mine died, right? You know, I had been a lifeguard for a long period of time, and I learned CPR and all those kind of good stuff. And well, she was She was dying on the floor in the living room, and I couldn't save her. You know? Whatever I could do wasn't good enough, you know? There you go again, not good enough, you know? Failure, all this. But when I saw her and she was lying dead there, you know, I saw a peace, right? I saw that she would never have to hurt again. That the problems that she had, the struggles, the fears, all of that stuff was gone. And I wanted that, you know? Like, that really was something that I wanted. You know, and it talks about that in our book. You know, we come to a crossroads or a turning point, right? And for me, that was it. You know, something stopped me from doing what my idea was going to be. My idea was, as I've got rent money, and I have a fifth of vodka hidden, I got enough to kill myself. But somehow or another, you know, the EMS lady said, "No, you're coming with us, man. You're not staying here. You're coming with us. You're going to the hospital. You're coming with us." So I went to the hospital with them, you know, and they revived her and they pronounced her dead at the hospital and everything like that. But you know, what was pretty amazing is that all of a sudden there was some family around. You know, there was people calling, there was people checking up on me, and that gave me some hope. You know, so I made some phone calls and I called up the Ridgeview and they said, "Hey, we don't have any beds. Call tomorrow." All right, I called tomorrow, and I kept on calling, and then one day they said, "We got a bed. You got to be here at 7 o'clock in the morning." So, all right, great. So I come up here and I get here at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I don't know, must have been 4-6 hours later, sitting up in the access center, that I was finally admitted into Camp Ridgeview, and they brought me over here to the day hospital. I met Mel, who was my small group leader at that point in time, you know, and he asked me a few things. "What are you doing here?" And I said, I'm here to, you know, because I got a problem with drugs and alcohol." And he goes, "No, really, why are you here?" And I'm like, "Well, what the hell is this guy?" I just told him, you know. "I'm here because I have a problem with drugs and alcohol." "Well, why are you here?" And I said, "Because I want to get sober, man." He's like, "No, do you want to get sober, or does somebody else want you to get sober?" And I said, "No, you know what, dude? I really do. You know what I mean? I do. Because, you know, I had been sober since the 4th, and it was the 11th. You know, the first night I was there at my mom's house, she introduced me to who is now my sponsor. You know, he's been my sponsor since that day, you know. He took me to my first meeting that night, and I love this guy to this day, you know. He's always got my back. I love this man. And, you know, and he helped me out, and he kept me sober. He showed me a few things, enough to keep me wanting it until I could get here, you know. And when I got here, you know, I didn't want anything still. You know, I was angry. I was very angry. I was angry at the world. I was, you know, going through a lot of grief. You know, I was still pissed off. And I didn't want to deal with me. I didn't want to deal with me at all. And I knew that was going to happen, is that I was going to have to deal with me. And another thing, man, is On Sundays, you know, they've got this, the thing where you guys come up. I don't know if some of you might stay at the halfway house or if you're familiar with it or anything like that. They have this thing on Sundays. And Father Knowles at the time was the dude who did the thing, you know, the spirituality thing on Sundays. We were required to come up here from the halfway house. They'd kick us out. You know, but I wouldn't come in here because I didn't want that God or that stuff that AA was talking about. I still didn't want that. Yeah, I might have wanted to get sober, right? I didn't want to drink anymore. I was starting to feel a little bit healthier, and I was starting to feel a little bit like, okay, you know, maybe I'm really not the piece of shit that everybody said I was. Maybe I am worth something, you know? But I didn't want to hear what he had to say, you know? And one day he comes out to me, and he's like, dude, how come you're always sitting out here? And I said, man, I said, you know, take no offense to it. I'm sure what you got to say in there, you know, helps out a lot of people, but it's not for me. You know, it's just not for me. And he goes, what do you mean it's not for you? And I said, well, you know, that spirituality, that God, whatever it is, that higher power, you know, you guys mask it, you trickery, you know, brainwashing, you know, all that kind of cult stuff, you know. That's not for me, you know what I mean? I'm not going to fall into that. You know, I got this, you know what I mean? He goes, really, dude? You got it, huh? I said, yeah. He's like, well, you got you here, that's for sure, but you don't got this, man. And he handed me this card. Right, and said Father Knowles on it. And on this card, man, I want to make business cards like this. You know, it has all these really cool things. It said, you know, integrity, selflessness, compassion, hope, faith, service. You know, these words that, you know, kind of intrigue me because I wasn't any of those, you know? I didn't know what that meant, really. You know, those were in the storybooks, you know, that people like that were like superheroes and things, you know, they weren't me, and I wasn't going to be able to attain any of those things. Until one day, you know, it was a Saturday afternoon, and I woke up, man, and I had these cravings, and I don't know if anybody can relate this to it or not, but man, these cravings were just awful. It was like they were so strong, you know, all day long, and I was trying to use whatever little bit of tools that I knew how to use to get rid of it, but I couldn't do it, man. I couldn't do it. And they were so strong, and I went down to lunch, and I came back up to the men's halfway house, and I was on the smoke deck, you know, and I. It was so intense, man, I could feel the vodka going down the back of my throat, right? I could smell it in my nose, okay? And I couldn't handle it. You know, I was thinking, you know what? This isn't a lockdown campus. You know, I could walk right out down this road. I'm sure I could walk down here somewhere. And I could get what I need to get rid of this. You know what I mean? But instead, I screamed at the top of my lungs to the sky, get this the fuck out of me. And as soon as I said that, man, it was gone. That craving that I had been fighting myself all day long, that I could not get rid of. The very, very first time I asked for help, it happened. It took those cravings away. So there had to have been something. For me, at least, you know, that kind of made me think a little bit for myself for a second. Dude, what? I just asked for help and it was gone, you know? And then it reminded me of the one time, dude, I had just gotten this brand new Honda Civic and I was cruising, I was drunk, and I wanted to end my life. So instead, So what I decided to do was, they've got those huge metal steel utility poles, right, that hang up, and they got the traffic lights that go over big, huge, major intersections and stuff like that. So I decide, man, I'm just going to gun it, and I nail it, and I hit this thing head on, right, and it practically splits the car completely in half. But I hear a voice that says, not yet. Right? And after I have this experience and the smoke, that it reminds me of that experience. Right? So now all of a sudden I'm starting to understand that there may be something outside of me that has been with me and that is protecting me, and I didn't know it. I was ignorant. I was too self-absorbed. There was something. I was being blocked, right? And I remember this one day, I'm talking with my sponsor, and I still have all this anger, right? And some people call it a Napoleon complex, whatever it is, man. I'm angry at the world, you know what I mean? And I still have a problem with that now and again. I do. Knowing's half the battle, right? That's what G.I. Joe says. I'm talking to my sponsor, and he's like, man, dude, you're angry, man. You're angry. You're angry all the time. Why don't you write this stuff down? Before I know it, I'm working on a fourth step. Here we go. Wasn't planning on, but so we're on a four step, right? And he's like, okay, now here's the deal, man. Is you're gonna write down these three columns, and he's like, and it's right there in the book, and you can look at it, it's on this page, and we're gonna write down, where your fears are and this and this, and we're gonna and I'm looking at it, dude, and all right, look, I'm not real book smart. I got through high school barely. I didn't turn in a lot of assignments. I never wrote 3-page essays. School was not my thing. So now I'm looking at this and math and this, all this, So I'm looking at this thing, dude, and it's making me feel dumb. I am real dumb because I do not understand how to put all this pissed off at this stuff right now. Is that a word? It is? All right, cool. So I can't figure out how to put all this stuff down in these three columns and this AA equation and stuff like that, because I'm not smart enough to figure it out. I'm getting more and more pissed. I'm dumb, right? And my sponsor's like, dude, chill out. You know what? Just do it. Put stuff down on paper. Stop erasing it. Stop throwing it away. Just put it down and bring it. Whatever you got, we'll go through it, right? So we plan this day, and at this point now, when I left Ridgeview, I couldn't stay sober on my own. I found that out. 30 days turned into 40 days, and the 30th day I walked down to see Sam, because I was like, yeah, I'm going out today, Sam. And he's like, what's your name again? And I tell him, and he's like, I don't have you on the coin out list. And who's your case manager? And I said, Mel. He's like, yeah, you probably want to go talk to him. Well, there's got to be a mistake here. You know what I mean? I know that Chris is a common name, so So Mel tells me that no, dude, you're not leaving today. We got you signed up for another 10 days. So my 30 days turns into 40 days, and I'll tell you what, man. Those last 10 days are the best 10 days of my entire, were the best 10 days of the 40 days that I spent here, because the fact is that I wasn't concentrating on day 22, day 24. You know what I mean? I wasn't concentrating on when I was getting out. And those last 10 days, I really learned something, and I learned that I couldn't do this on my own, so I went to a sober living place, right? And at that sober living place, at that pool, was where my sponsor and I, we sat down, we went through my fifth step, And I told this guy, who were months back I hardly knew, or I didn't know at all. And now I'm telling this guy everything about my life and where things happened and how I felt. All of a sudden I got emotions, right? I didn't have any emotions before. I didn't ever learned any emotions. I knew one thing, that I was pissed off, but I didn't know what that meant. You know what I mean? I'm all of a sudden getting a snapshot of what these emotions look like, what they feel like, and I'm starting to understand what they are, you know? And then, you know, we go through the whole thing, and some people always say that, you know, you hear, you know, wow, after my fifth step, it was like this explosion, and I felt great, my whole entire life was, and you know, good. That wasn't the case for me. And the reason why, for me, it wasn't the case is because it was so overwhelming, you know? I had to digest it all, you know? And then once it all kind of caught up to me, I called him up and I'm like, and he's like, relax, everything's cool, man. Everything's cool, you know? You did a great job. Now let's look at that stuff. Let's find out what was fear like, you know? You know, what's pride, you know? Where was your security, you know, harmed, or what are those things? And what kind of characteristics do those bring out? And then, you know, and we, you know, as we're working through this, you know, and then and he's like you have a real hard time with forgiving yourself, man. He goes, you know, do you believe in a higher power now? Are you there yet? And he's like, because you know, I know that you tell me that you pray, and I know that we walk through some of this stuff, but tell me honestly, are you just trying, do you believe? And I said, yeah. He's like, do you believe that God or your higher power has forgiven you for those things that you did? I said, well, yeah. He goes, are you God? No. So if God, all-encompassing, all-powerful, the realm of the universe, spirit, if that power can forgive you for the things that you did, why can't you? Right? If he makes you and then forgives you for the things that you did, why can't you forgive you? So I had to ask him. I had to humbly ask my higher power to remove the character defects that were inside me. You know? And some of those character defects was the fact that I had no self-esteem, man. I had what they... Here's the thing I learned, is self-esteem is I thought that I didn't have a self-esteem, right? But I did have a self-esteem. I thought I was a piece of shit. So there you go. I have a self-esteem. Because my esteem for myself is shit. So that means I think of myself in some way, so therefore I have self-esteem. You know? But I learned that I wasn't that anymore. You know? Or that I didn't have to be that. You know, it came up to a point now where he's like, you know, remember, dude, remember when we did the fifth step? And in that fourth step, there was some names. He's like, I want you to write some names down on a piece of paper. I'm going to build a list. So I build this list, you know, because I'm catching on here. You know, I figured out now here's a list of people that I'm going to eventually have to go and, you know, talk to about some of this stuff that I've done, right? And so I make it real easy on myself. I'm going to write down five. Because I know these five people are going to be like, yeah, it's all right, cool, man. You know what I mean? I'm done. I got my list. And he's like, no, man, I remember going down that thing with you. I remember we did this together, right? And I remember seeing on that list that there was a few more people on there. You might want to check that out. So, you know, so we did that. And I put down those people. I put down everybody. And then on that list, you know, I knew that there was going to be some people that I would never, ever be able to apologize to, or I'm sorry, make amends to, right? Because you know, some of them didn't live in the country anymore, some I just didn't, you know, weren't going to be able to get a hold of somehow. Some of them were dead, you know? But I did the list, because it's in the list, you know, became willing to make amends to them all. So I put down this list, right? So we start to go through the part where I get prepared for some 9-step amends, right? And he's like, look, man, I don't want you just walking out there and going and knocking on people's doors, ringing people up on the phone and all this kind of stuff and going out and doing this on your own. You need to check with me first, okay? Call me up. We'll walk through it. I'll get you prepared for it. We'll know what we need to do in order for you to go out there and make these amends. And I said, all right. So a couple of them went really well, you know, and the people that I made amends to were receptive. They're like, you know, Chris, we're just really happy that you're not doing what you were doing before, you know. And hell, man, you look pretty good. You know, you shaved the beard, the Charlie Manson thing's gone. You look good, dude. You know what I mean? So that was nice. And then there was some that, you know, that didn't work out so good. And then there was the one that I needed to make, and to the friend who died. We had spent some time together in Destin, Florida, and I had gone down there to Destin with my sponsor to a conference down there. They have a wonderful conference down there in Destin, Florida. So we went down there, and we had planned that I was going to make it an amends. So I found a spot on the beach where, you know, I was going to make my amends. And are you guys familiar with seagulls? Yeah, and there's seagulls, and then there's like they travel in like packs of like 30 to 100 of them all the time, you know. So I sit down, and only this one seagull lands in front of me, right when I'm about ready to start my amends. And then this one seagull sits there. And I don't know, maybe it took me about 15 minutes, you know, to get through it. You know, and I said it out loud. And then as soon as I said amen, you know, the seagull just took off, you know, just flew away. You know, and for me, that really, really, I think that was one of those God shots, you know, that my higher power was there with me, and that maybe this person was there as well, and that I was actually saying my amends through this seagull. I mean, and it kind of sounds kind of, but that's how I felt, that this is truly something really cool, you know. You know, some of the amends, like I said, they came back to haunt me. I had made some phone calls to make some. I know I'd been out there long enough, and I'd done some damage. So there's got to be some stuff out there that needs to be cleared. So I get on the phone, and I start calling counties. And hey, this is Chris, and my Social Security number is, and my birth date is. Do you have anything on me? Do you have any warrants? Do you have any tickets? Do you have anything for me? And some of them were like, no. No, we don't. We don't have anything. And then there was a couple that, you know, okay, just got to make a couple of fines and things like that. So I figured I've cleared the road, everything's good. And about 2 years into my sobriety, 2.5 years, something like that, and change, all of a sudden I get a letter in the mail that I'm being charged with a DUI. And then 2 days later, I'm being charged with another DUI. See, there was two DUIs that never got gone to, I never went to court for, that kind of caught up. You know, Fulton County and City of Atlanta finally caught up, 2.5, you know, 9 and 11 years later, they want to charge me for these things. And I got 2.5 years of sobriety. And they want to throw the book at me, man. They want to lock me up for like 6 months. And I'm telling, you know, my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, I'm like, look, you know, they want to throw me away, you know. They want, this is what the lawyer's saying, the prosecution, this is what they want to do. And I remember one thing that they told me when I was here was they told me, they're like, you know what, Chris, you need to build a network. Get numbers. Go shake hands to speakers. Thank the chairperson at the meeting. Thank the discussion leader at the meeting. Stand in and thank the guy who made coffee. Get their number. You know what I mean? Build a network, because you will never know When there comes a time in your life that you may need to lean or ask for help from any of those people. And thank goodness that at some point in time I learned how to take some suggestions, and I did that, because here was the time. My lawyer said, dude, you need to find out if you can get a paragraph from a bunch of people that we can go in front of the judge and say, hey, you know what, judge? The Chris that you have on that paper, the one that did those things, is not the Chris that's here today. Right? And these people did, man. They did. These people emailed me a paragraph, and they said some kind words about me. You know, which was, I wasn't really asking for that, but I was asking for something, you know what I mean? And when I got to the judge, and the judge, and I gave a big stack of these, you know what I mean? And she looked at him and she's like, you're a model citizen. No, she didn't say that. Wouldn't that be great? No, she said that. She's like, you know what? People like you, you know, you're rehabilitated, you know, and there's no reason really for me to throw you in jail. I don't think that'll do anything for you. I think it might actually harm you. But what I'm going to do is that I'm going to give you 4 days. We're going to knock this 6 months down. We're going to give you 4 days. You're going to have to come in on a Friday afternoon, check yourself in, and then we'll release you 4 days later. I said, okay. So, of course, I go there and I do this. You know, I get in jail, and then they're like, hey, what are you doing here? We're eating the bologna sandwiches and stuff, and the green hot dogs. What are you doing here? What are you doing here? Finally, you know, I told the guys, I was trying to change my life around, and I turned myself in. You know what I mean? And they're like, what, dude? Man, you gotta believe this. Come on over here. This dude right here, he's crazy. He turned himself in. Man, they gotta come and get me, man. I turned myself, you know. But they left me alone, which was great. Because now I'm gonna be left alone because they don't wanna be next to me, man. This guy's crazy. He turns himself in. So I was cool, you know. I got left alone for those 4 days. And when I got my 4 days out, you know, it was really humbling. You know, I got to see, you know, the inside of a jail for the first time, sober. You know, that was never ever the case for me. But so what I do nowadays, you know, is I'm thankful for all those experiences that I got through my 9-step. You know, and that what I do is. You know, at nights when I try to, I don't do this every night, I'm not going to lie to you, but I do try and do it. I had them written down. There's the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous also have, there's a principle behind each one of them, right? Honesty, hope, faith, courage, integrity, willingness, humility, brotherly love, self-discipline, perseverance, awareness of God and service. Now, those are the 12 spiritual principles behind each of these steps, right? So if I do a snapshot of my day and I look and I'm like, okay, because it talks about, you know, that we need to practice these spiritual experiences and these spiritual principles in all of our affairs, right? So I got to take this thing of that I'm learning in Alcoholics Anonymous, I gotta apply it to my life, right? I don't act one way in the rooms and then I go out and act like a fool and whatever else, you know what I mean? So I gotta keep myself accountable. So I got this list and I go through and I try and check. You know, did I do this today? Was I honest with myself? Was I honest with others? Was I willing to try and do something different? Did I have the courage to face something that I didn't want to face before? Did I help another brother out? You know what I mean? Those things. And if I hit a couple, cool, you know, and then I've had a good day. At least I've tried, you know. And then I try to look, and I look, and I see one or two of the ones that I didn't hit that day, and I try to make sure that I try to attack that the next day. You know, that's how I handle that, right? Because I got to keep myself in check, you know what I mean? And I got to thank my higher power for giving me the opportunity to do the things that I can do today, you know. I don't have to think about me all the time, you know, which is great. You know, you know, coming out here tonight, you know, thank you all so much. You know, you kept me sober today. You know, and when Steve contacted me and said, you know, Chris, you know, we want you to come out and do it, you know. Man, you put some stuff in my bank, you know what I mean? Like, I was able to stay sober, you know what I mean, through that period of time, you know, because I knew I was going to be coming here, you know. And that's the thing is, like, I never know when I'm going to have to go and look and lean on the things that I've learned. Because some days I get lifed on. And it hurts. Right? And some days I sit in an meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and it sucks. Because I think I didn't get anything. But the thing is that I do each time I go to a room. You know, I learn something and I try to take it with me everywhere I go, you know. You know, and I always wanted to be the unique one, right? I had this terminal uniqueness. But what's cool now is that there's millions of us out there, right? There's a lot of us out there. And a lot of us that are still suffering from this disease. And there might be some of you in this room, right? And that's okay. But the thing is that I can be a unique alcoholic. I can be a unique drug addict because I can be a recovering alcoholic drug addict. And that's unique because not all of us get here. Right? So I'm grateful for being here. You know, thank you all for keeping me sober tonight, you know? All you guys here tonight, you know, you're all miracles, and I believe that. Because it was a miracle if I could get it. A day, an hour of sobriety, you know? You all been sitting here since about 7:45, so I know you got more than an hour of sobriety. So hey, give yourselves a hand. Thank you.